Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. And I want to welcome you to Religion Means a Lie. I happen to be offered the opportunity to again stand in for the host of A Religion Means a Lie, Imam Alfred Muhammad. My name is Abdul Rashid Akbar. This is the regular user time where I co-host with Imam Muhammad, but today I will be carrying the hosting responsibilities by myself. So, as always, I want to greet you with the greetings of peace, the greetings of all the prophets from Adam the first to Muhammad the last. The greetings of peace, assalamu alaikum. May peace be upon you. I have several topics I want to discuss today. And if you'd like to join the conversation, then you're welcome to do so. All you need to do is to dial in at 805-727-7013 to listen or to participate. If you want to ask a question or participate, just dial 1 on your telephone dial, and I'll respond to your question right away. Along with that, let me also say this. You can send me a tweet. That's another way. I'm into social media. So there's another way that you can participate. You can send me a tweet to, of course, twitter.com, and my handle is at Akbar1. That's at AKBARONE, Akbar1. All right. With that introduction, let's get into the program for the day. The last time I had an opportunity to address the Religion Means a Lie audience, I left with instructions that maybe we should address and deal a little bit with an issue that is prominent not just in business and technology areas in the African American community, but also in the broader community. And one of these issues is this whole thing about being afraid to fail, the fear of failure. In a lot of respects, that can hold us back in our business efforts. And so, I told Imam Alfred that I would address that in future presentations here on the Blog Talk Radio, here, Religion Means a Lie. And so today we'll begin with this, the whole issue of being afraid to fail. There's an old adage, or a saying, if you want to use a different type of terminology, and it's usually stated in this way. For those who are afraid to fail, they wind up being, if you're afraid to fail, you will not be successful. It's impossible to be successful without some failures, because everything that you go at is not going to be successful. Really, being afraid of failing really contributes to holding many people back. Now, you know, my particular show usually focuses on technology and business. And today, it would also focus in that area. And, you know, the old adage that they say, when you're starting a business, if you're in the business, they say, well, you know, starting a business and running a business is risky. There's a saying that says that 9 out of 10 businesses fail. Well, that may be true. But I want to call your attention to a author that I have a great respect for. I'm going to reference this author and some of the things he said. And then I'm going to outline or highlight a business that's in the news recently that has failed. But I want to talk a little bit about what they've been able to do. And that for many, they look at failure as just, well, this is the price of being in business. So let me go to the office that I want to reference. And his name is Robert Kiyosaki, actually Robert T. Kiyosaki. And he's the author of many business books, financial educational books. It all started with his premier book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And then the entire title of the book is Rich Dad, Poor Dad, What the Rich Teach Their Kids About Money That the Poor and Middle Class Do Not. I was introduced to this book, at least it has to be now almost 10 years ago. And I was so impressed with this particular book. I read several of his other publications. And then I used this book and his second book as a companion to this book, The Cash Flow Quadrant. I used them in classes I teach that I taught on financial literacy, how to become more literate and be more knowledgeable of handling money and being financially secure. So I want to reference him. This information comes from his Rich Dad, Poor Dad book. And it's the whole thing about fear. I'm referencing chapter 8 from his book. And the chapter is entitled Overcoming Obstacles. And the first point he highlights is fear. So let me just read just a few things and quotes from his book. Overcoming the fear of losing money. I have never met anyone who really likes losing money. And in all my years, I have never met a rich person who has never lost money. But I have met a lot of poor people who have never lost a dime. Fear of losing money is real. Everyone has it, even the rich. But it's not fear that is the problem. It's how to handle fear, and that's very important. And let me just read that again. But it's not fear that is the problem. It's how to handle fear. It's how you handle losing. It's how you handle failure in one's life. That goes for anything in life, not just money. So stop there. Very important quote, a very important lesson he lays out here. And I want to point to the audience's attention. Failure in business is almost inevitable. Very few have gone into business, as he says here, and have not lost over time in any of the enterprises. But, as he says here, how do you handle the fear? How do you handle it, and what do you do with it? That's extremely important. Now, let me go on and continue to quote from his from this particular segment. The primary difference between a rich person and a poor person is how they handle that fear. It's okay to be fearful. It's okay to be a coward when it comes to money. They'll be rich. We're all heroes at something and cowards at something else. He says, my rich dad understood phobias about money. Some people are terrified of snakes. Some people are terrified about losing money. Both are phobias, he would say. So his solution to the phobia of losing money was this little rhyme. You hate risk and worry. Start early. Now he's quoting the individual that his book is based on. He's referred to as his rich dad. Now, I'm quoting from this book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I think I should give just a little background on the book and give you some context. Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Well, you know, all of us can only have one father. And Robert, he only had one father also. He had his best friend's father who was close to him. Now, his biological father was a highly educated man. He had PhDs from the University of Chicago and Stanford University. And he went on to become the head of the education department in the state of Hawaii, where Robert was raised. And so his biological dad was highly educated, but his biological dad had a job. Now, his best friend's dad was, he didn't go beyond high school. Best friend dad educated himself in the area of business. He took classes, seminars, and educated himself in the area of business. And he taught his son, and since Robert was close to us, and his son's best friend, agreed to also tutor Robert. But he told Robert that he wouldn't teach him like he's been taught in school. Anyway, to give you the context, Robert, who was his rich dad and who was his poor dad? Well, Robert says his poor dad was his highly educated dad, his biological dad. And his rich dad was his best friend's dad, the one who didn't have much education in terms of academics, but was very educated in building and operating businesses and investing, and became one of the wealthiest men in the whole state of Hawaii. And there were lessons that he taught Robert, and Robert had to make a choice. Which dad was he going to follow? Which dad's advice was he going to follow? His poor dad would always tell him, Robert, you need to go to school to get a good job. First, you could get a good education, and you can get a good job where you can get a nice home and have a nice family home, and that you can retire with a nice pension. And that's what his highly educated dad told him. Of course, his rich dad told him that, Robert, yes, go to school, but go to school to get an education so you can learn to build businesses. Learn how to build businesses, how to understand and read financial documents and understand them, and then how to become independently wealthy, or what he would refer to as becoming financially free, So I want to give you that context so you'll understand what I'm talking about, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. For those who are not familiar with Mr. Kiyosaki and haven't read the book. But so when I talk about his rich dad taught him, now you have a context. So let me go back now to this whole issue of fear. And you'll see where I'm going to connect it here with this whole idea of being afraid to fail. Going back to his book now. My rich dad understood phobias about money. As I repeat, some people are afraid of snakes. Some people are terrified about losing money. Both are phobias, he would say. So his solution, again, to the phobias of losing money was this little rhyme, and I want to repeat. If you hate risk and worry, start early. That's why banks recommend savings. is a habit when you're young. If you start young, it's easy to be rich. It won't go into it, I won't go into it here, but there's a large difference between a person who starts saving at age 20 versus a person who starts their saving at age 30. He says it's a staggering difference. All right, so let me move on to other areas of his book now. And again, dealing with fear. Dad went on to explain now. For some people, the reason they don't win financially is because the pain of losing money is far greater than the joy of being rich. Rich Dad used to tell Mike, which is his best friend, and these stories about his trips to Texas. Now, I don't want to repeat any more from that. Let me move on and move down to this quote. Failure inspires winners. Let me say this again. Failure inspires winners. And failure defeats losers. It is the biggest secret for winners. It's the secret that losers do not know. The greatest secret of winners is that failure inspires winning. Thus, they're not afraid of losing. All right. So, now let me leave it to Kiyosaki for the quotes now and go to what is a real practical lesson here in the real world in terms of business. Just recently in the business pages here of the Chicago Tribune, this is July 9th, let me read you this headline, and this is by Phil Rosenthal, who's a writer. A sweet fad goes stale. Don't fret over cupcakes. And the headline under that is crumbs. Closing doesn't necessarily mean end of a trend. You can't sugarcoat change missteps. All right. So let me quote from Mr. Rosenthal's article. The Crumbs Bake Shop gourmet cupcake chain seems to be toast. But it's not like someone left a cake out in the rain, and we'll never have that recipe again. It's not the end of cupcakes, comfort food, or decadent indulgence. There will always be someone somewhere to sell us something we don't really need at a price we really shouldn't pay because, heck, we deserve a treat every now and then. Our national sugar Jones will not be denied. It's just that, good as Crumbs cupcakes were, all appetites have limits. Crumbs, 6-5 signature, 500-plus calorie sugar bombs, at as much as $4.50 a pop, may well have been too rich for most people, one way or another. But belts loosen as well as tighten. More critical was the determination of Crumb's leadership to bite off more than it could swallow in terms of store expansion. And I continue to quote, when Crumb's debuted on NASDAQ 3 years ago at $13.10 a share, giving the company a market value of about $59 million, despite a sense that consumers' fascination with high-end cupcakes might have crested, it already was the largest cupcake chain. All right. So, and of course, when we say debut on NASDAQ, I mean they went to the public market and sold shares to investors to invest in their company. But again, as he says here, they were already the largest cupcake chain. And co-founder, now I continue to quote, co-founder Jason Barber acknowledged how an ill-advised expansion some years earlier had led the phenomenal popular donut chain Krispy Kreme to crash. And for all those who know Krispy Kreme donuts, I was one, and several of their varieties was a favorite of mine. But they did eventually go bankrupt. Now, you can still find Krispy Kreme donuts out, but nothing like they were in their heyday. And so, let me return to the article. That was the downfall of the brand, Barbara told Reuters at the time. Yet, Barbara, who with his eventual wife had grown Crumbs to a 35-outlet operation, selling 1.5 million cupcakes a month within 8 years of opening their first Manhattan store in 2003. Also said he hoped to open 200 Crumb stores by 2014, unquote. Now, it seems, as Mr. Rosenthal is pointing out, it seems like Mr. Barber with Crumbs was making the same error that the managers of Krispy Kreme were making, and that is growing, and maybe just growing a little too fast. All right, I'm going to return to this article. Crumbs' company website Tuesday still referred to on Tuesday's. This is a Wednesday, July 9th article. So I guess it was Tuesday of that week. Crumbs' company website, Tuesday, still referred to 78 locations around the country as its delisted shares traded over the counter for less than a nickel. But when it shut down Monday night, the chain reportedly was down to 50 outlets, including a couple in Chicago. In a post-closing statement, the chain said it would continue to weigh its limited remaining options. All right, so let me stop there. So, this is a real-world example of a business failing, and a business that had gone to the public market, raised money in the public market, had a 35-location operation, selling millions of products every month, but they still fail, because when you go bankrupt, you fail. But let me continue to talk about now. In fact, let me refer back to a quote from the article from the managers just before I stop. The statement said, "We continue to weigh our limited remaining options." And what that sent the message was, yeah, we may have failed, but we have some options here. Even though they may be limited, there are some options here. And we're going to review them. Now, here's an article now I want to quote to you. An article from the Chicago Tribune. This is Friday, July 11th. So this article came out just about 2 days after Mr. Rosenthal's article. And the pattern of this article is CNBC star may salvage Crumbs. And the article is written by two Tribune reporters, Becky, I think it's Yurek, and Melissa Harris. And now, let me quote from this article. Marcus, I think his last name is Leminis. I think it's L-E-M-O-N-I-S. Marcus Leminis, a local investor and star of CNBC's reality show The Prophet, is working on a deal to resurrect Crumbs gourmet cupcake stores. which closed all of its locations this week. So now I'm seeing for them, in this article, they're saying they closed all of their locations. Right. Quoting Mr. Liminus, I am in the process of working on a strategy to resolve the business issues that exist there and get it going again, Mr. Liminus told the Tribune. Now, he's speaking about crumbs. I don't know what form and substance that's going to take on. I did lend them some money today to take care of impending issues. Now, just think about this now. Mr. Liminus has loaned them some money. Now, this is a company that went bankrupt. So, Mr. Liminus must have seen something of value here. All right. So, let me continue. Liminus declined to disclose the amount of the loan, but said it wasn't mind-boggling. Liminus is working with other investors to form a new entity that would include candy maker Sweet Peaks, which he owns. All right, so, working on a strategy, developing a new entity, what some would call restructuring. Among the investors is the Fisher family, which also presides over Dippin' Dots Ice Cream, the network reported. All right, so, further down in the article, I quote, Crumbs CEO Edward Slezak confirmed in his statement that the company is in talks with various interested parties that are allowing us to pursue all of our options for the business, which includes considerations of restructuring alternatives. Shares of Crumbs, which went public in 2011, were delisted recently from the NASDAQ stock exchange for the year ended in April. All right, so now let me go back to the whole issue here and our discussion. The discussion is about failure and being afraid to fail. But in fact, in this case, I'm trying to say is not being afraid to fail. Here is a family that went into a business selling cupcakes, opened up 35 outlets. When they went into it, were making and selling millions of products a month. And it had a market cap in the financial markets of over $59 million. But still, they were not able to continue as a going concern, as they say. But here's someone, an investor who see some value in it and is talking to them about resurrecting the business under a different entity. All right, so I refer back to Mr. Kiyosaki's pronunciation in his article about fear. And he says, the important thing is not that you fail, but what to do with failure, how to respond to failure, not to be crushed by failure. And as you see here, even though the company may not be the same, may not be as big, may not have it, you have the same name, but it still may emerge from bankruptcy, and the original owners may not be a total loss. And they're going forward with working with investors who may have a plan to help them resurrect the business. So this is how they're addressing that particular failure. All right. So it may not be known as Crumbs anymore, but there's still value of that product, and someone else sees the value of the product, and is at least willing to explore the opportunity to invest in it and get into that business. So, what I want to say, this should be a lesson to all of us, those of us who are in business and who have a desire to go into business. Don't resist going into business because you're afraid to fail. You cannot succeed taking risks. And as long as those risks are calculated. And even then, if you calculate the risk and you move cautiously and things don't work out exactly like you like, some may say, well, you failed at that. But you can simply say, well, I've learned a lot from that, so this next project that I'm going to go into, I should be much more successful at. And that's the important way, how to handle a failure, how to respond to it. There's something else that Mr. Kiyosaki mentions that his rich dad told him and that he keeps with him and continues to teach those who read his books and listen to his lectures. That old adage that 9 out of 10 businesses fail, well, his response was, or his rich dad's response was, okay, well, that just means I need to start 10 businesses. So he just turned that negative into a positive. I need to start 10 businesses. All right. So if 9 out of 10 fail, I need to start 10. Because the experiences that I'm going to learn from those 9 failures, when that 10 won't take off, it will pay for all of those quote-unquote failures that came before the one that was most successful. And so he would also say that, you know, that's not really truly a failure in a business because there's always something that you're going to learn. You're going to look at how that business operated, what are some of the challenges it had in the business. And so if you didn't achieve exactly what you wanted in that business, again, does not mean that you have failed. It simply means that that particular business did not work out exactly as you wanted. But now, let's take the lessons from operating that business, and now let's move on to the next business or the next project. All right, very important. All right, and so that would be the way to really handle that quote-unquote that fear of failure. Also, I want to point out there's another lesson in the Crumbs saga here. And so I want to refer to an article from the Chicago Tribune on an address that Reverend Major Johnson gave to the Restaurant Association convention here in Chicago this year. And they have several highlights in their article. But for this one, I just want to quote one, and this comes from him. He says, pace growth. Grow at a slow, disciplined rate, he advised. We all want growth and sustainability. Don't grow too fast. Don't take on contracts that you can't deliver on, he said. He says, I passed on contracts when I first got started because I couldn't deliver. But that same contract came back around later when I was in a position to deliver, and he got the contract. So that's important. Pace yourself if you're in business. Don't attempt to grow too fast. There'll be some who say, well, you're in business. The bankruptcy laws are written in a way so that you can continue to go forward. If you fail at one thing, you file bankruptcy, close that particular operation up, learn what you learned from it, and then go on and do other things. But you don't open a business to fail. You open a business to be successful. And so if you can take on some advice, you could look at the experience of the individuals who ran Crumbs and also those who ran Krispy Kreme. And what they would say is, don't grow too fast. As Major Johnson says, pace your growth. Be patient. Don't take on more than you can deliver on. And just try to manage the growth so you have an opportunity to be successful in your business operation. Okay. So that's what I want to talk about in the first part of the show today, this whole thing of being afraid to fail and how you can address a failure. So before I leave this topic, let me just recap and what I'd like to leave with you. Don't be afraid to fail. You cannot be successful without experiencing failure. Understand it's not the fear of failing that you should be concerned about. It's just how to handle the fear. So if you fail at something, the important thing is how do you handle that failure? Do you respond to it? Do you redouble your efforts and you go on just doing other things that are new? Or do you just assume that you're not going to be able to go forward and you just give up altogether? My advice to you would be not to take that defeatist attitude, but to continue to go forward. Take the lessons you learned from that particular project that did not pan out like you wanted to, and what other people refer to as a failure. But take the lessons from that and then move forward. And then I would hope that you also reach out to those who can be of assistance to you with knowledge and information and move forward. Hopefully you will be successful in that next project or operation that you embark upon. Now, let me move to the next segment, the next topic that I want to address in the presentation today. And this is an ongoing topic, one that I will come back to hopefully on future presentations here on Religion Means a Lot. And that is supporting African-American businesses. Supporting African-American businesses. And primarily for African-Americans to support African-American businesses. Now, of course, I'm sure African-American business owner, myself being one, would encourage support from anywhere. But we certainly would like to find and be able to depend on support from those in our own communities, those of us who have shared experiences and can see the value of, understand the value of strong African-American business in our community. I am reminded of this topic when it came up on a radio show that I listen to often. It's the Al Sharpton's radio show. And, of course, this topic came up. There was a spirited discussion about supporting African-American businesses. And some of the callers who called in, some of them were business owners, some of them were customers who would like to maybe support African-American businesses even more, but don't know how to identify them, or don't know how to find them. I heard this from several callers, and I was somewhat shocked. But also what that tells me is that there's an opportunity out there. I'll come back to this particular point later on in this part of our discussion. But let me move on now. Some of the callers who called in on this show were African-American business owners. And, of course, they approached this whole idea from a different perspective. Of course, as they say, they would love to have the African-American community be more supportive of their businesses and services. And so they would help them grow and prosper. But there's one important point. One of the callers, and I'm reminded of that now, one of the callers who was a business owner stated, he said, when I open up my business and I open it up in the African-American community, when customers will come in, he said, the first thing that they would ask is, what kind of deal are you going to give me? Now, of course, I'm in business. I have to compete with all the other businesses in the area. I have rent and other business expenses that I have to address. So the price of my products was quite competitive with the surrounding businesses. And, of course, you know, the margins, and that is the difference between the price that the owner has to pay for the item and then a product and then what he can charge, or he or she can charge for it. That spread in there, that margin, sometimes can be very tight. It may be as low as 3 to 4, maybe 5%. And so when someone comes in to a business, see the stated price of the product on the shelf, and then you ask the business owner, okay, I want to shop here with you. So what kind of deal you want to give me? And this kind of puts those middle business owners in a difficult situation. Now, his response was, well, I'm already giving you a great deal, but the product is priced at now. But many of his customers would say, well, that's not good enough. That's what they're charging down the street. But I'm coming in to you. So I'm expecting you, because I'm not making you, I'm expecting you to give me a good deal and a lower price. Of course, that's coming from the customer's perspective, but it's unfortunate that we do that, that some of us do that, because they really don't understand what that business owner, the operator, has to contend with. For the most part, the prices that they price their products or services at, they price them in such a way that they can try to stay in business. And then, and as I said, they have a very small margin. So they really cannot afford to lower their prices anymore. Otherwise, they really would not be, in a lot of respects, not even breaking even. And they could be losing. And I don't think anyone will go into business and go into school through all of the challenges of operating a business and want them to lose money in the operation of the business. So I heard several business owners speak just to that particular concern. Then I had another business owner who stated that he had opened up his business, and he opened his business in an area that was multi-ethnic. It was multi-ethnic. That means it had more than just African-Americans living in the community. There were African-Americans, there were other ethnicities, Asians, Caucasians, and other ethnicities who lived in the area. And that he was doing well, servicing for the entire community. But he felt that that he may be able to do better if he were to move into an area that was predominantly African American. And so he did. And he found that that move hurt his business. There are African Americans that did come in and to patronize the business, but not to the volume that he had in the location where he had moved from, where he was drawing not just customers who were African American, but who are from the other ethnic groups. He said, so he eventually moved back in that area, and now he's been successful. And so what that communicated to him, and that was a learning experience, that as much as you like to cater to a particular community and focus on that, you do still have to operate a going business, and that you have to make ends meet. And then, of course, you'd like to make realize some results from your efforts and realize a profit. And so his advice to anyone who's going into business, whether it be a product where you're going to open up a retail establishment, or even if you're online, you can target a particular market that you want to focus on, but be open to all people who want to come in and patronize your business. Target a particular market, but be open to all people, because this can only help you be successful. We also understand the ups and downs of the economy. We know that people, when there's high unemployment and there's challenge and other economic challenges that people face, these disproportionately impact African Americans as opposed to other ethnic groups. And so, therefore, African American spending power is reduced in those high economic challenging times. And, of course, that means their disposable income is not that much, and where they have more limited resources to spend, other ethnic groups may have a little bit more and can help you weather those tough economic challenges in your business efforts. Also, as I listened to this call-in program and listened to the callers who called in, they spoke about the quality of service that they receive, and of course expected. And the good thing was, many of the African American businesses that their patronized attempted to deliver a high quality service and provide high quality products, or products that were on the same par as any of their competitors in the in that particular community. And that was good to hear. So now let me return to the point that I wanted to, that I made as I started on this discussion, supporting African-American businesses. The whole point of came up about designers and finding African-American designers, supporting African-American designers. How do you find them? How do you support them? What are some of the name brands? So that when you, even if you go into some of these big department stores and you're interested in buying clothing, what are some of the popular name designers so that you can support African-American designers so that you can support them? And some of the younger people are much more informed. But some of the callers called in and said, well, how do we find out? Where do we go? Is there a place that you can go that you can find out the name of some of the African American designers so that you can support them? Of course, we know that the advent of the computer, but also social media. That you can just, if you go to social media and ask that question, put the question out, what you're seeking, and there's certainly someone out there who can provide you information on individuals, either African-American designers or other individuals who are in business, African-Americans who are in business, who can use your services and use your support and be glad to get your support. That was a recommendation that you just go to Google and Google black or African-American fashion designers. That's one way you can do it. There's various publications out there. But even though there are these avenues, I heard from so many that they just didn't know where to go. Of course, everyone is not computer literate. Everyone doesn't have a computer. And in this day and time, but smartphones is also a way to tap into it. But again, maybe a lot of people don't have a smartphone or not using it or not used to using it to obtain information. What I say again, to me, this is an opportunity. Some time ago, I came on the program Religion Means Life, spoke about a online business directory that a group of African-American business individuals, entrepreneurs, had launched. And the focus of the directory was to be a place for African-American businesses that they can list their businesses or services, and that any individuals who are looking to support them can have at least one place they can go to online to identify these businesses and hopefully that they may want to do business with. The directory is this, the New Africa National Business Directory. The New Africa National Business Directory. So I thought I would like to bring this back to the attention of the listeners of Religion Means Life. The New Africa National Business Directory, the website is www.newafricanbd.com. That's www.newafricanbd.com. I would encourage the listeners here on the Religion Means Alive to go to the site. There are a few businesses up and we are striving to help and to encourage businesses to list their businesses on the site every day. We want that site to be that one-stop shop, that one place that anyone who's interested in patronizing African-American businesses, identifying African-American businesses that offer services that they would be interested in. We want this to be the place on the web that you can go and find it. So that's newafricanbd.com. And while you're there, if you don't see a business or service that is of interest to you and you'd like to see more, I would encourage you to drop us a line at the New Africa Group. Just drop us a line at our email address. And that's Akbar, AKBAR, at newafricagroup.com. Akbar at newafricagroup.com. Drop us an email and let us know what businesses you're looking for, what business you would like to see added to the directory. We continue to do outreach and encourage businesses to list. There is a fee for listing on the directory. And it is our hope that we can be that one-stop shop for businesses, African-American owned operating business. All right. So, continue with the subject of supporting African-American businesses. I simply want to now bring to your attention of the audience, Religion Means Alive audience. One of the shifts. I don't know if I discussed this on Religion Means Alive. Not absolutely sure. If I did, I hope you apologize for bringing it back, but I think it's important to do so. And that is the shift for Jet Magazine. Jet Magazine, of course, is published by Johnson Publishing, one of the largest African-American publishing concerns. And they have now moved from a printed version of the Jet Magazine to digital. And this is a shift, but it's a shift to be even more inclusive, to be more responsive to the reading audience. And because of the challenging times of the print business, and just because of the sheer cost. There's an article that was published in the Chicago Tribune highlighting the decision from the publisher of Jet to move from a printed publication to a digital format. And I want to go through that article now and quote. Now, the article is written by Robert Chenick, a Tribune writer or reporter. And now I quote from the article. Jet Magazine, the digest-sized publication that has been a staple among African-American readers for 63 years, is getting out of the print business. Johnson Publishing announced Wednesday that Jet, with a circulation of more than 700,000, will transition to a digital-only format in June. So now this article comes from an earlier Tribune publication data. I apologize, I don't see the date of the paper, but it was prior to this month, sometime in June, the article was published. Now I continue to quote from the article. The print version is going away, but the franchise is not going away, said Desiree Rogers, the CEO of Chicago-based Johnson Publishing Company. A new app, which will be available for tablets and all mobile devices, will publish weekly and will update breaking news daily. Excuse me. It will include video interviews, 3D charts, and archival photos, in addition to the content now available in the print edition. I simply want to relate and inform the Religion Means Alive listening audience that I had the pleasure of downloading the app to my iPad, and it is a phenomenal publication for those who are not technologically challenged, for those who have and understand how to use your either tablet, and I know it's available in the Apple on iTunes and the Apple App Store. I don't know where else it may be available, but it wasn't difficult to download and upload to my iPad. And it is really a stunning application, and it really goes way beyond what they could have done in the with the content in the printed format. The printed format, of course, you know, the Jet has been published for many years, and I can tell you that I was a subscriber, and but I want to relate the story of my mother because I think it's important to relate it at this point. My mother was a subscriber to not just to Jet, but also it's one of the larger publications, larger in terms of its format, from Johnson Publishing. Now, of course, Ebony is not going away. It's going to continue to be printed. And what they were arranged to do was to, when they discontinued the printed copy of Jet, all those who still had less subscriptions and still had timely subscriptions, what they did was to change them over to Ebony. And if they were already getting Ebony, they extended that subscription to Ebony so that those people would be made whole in terms of their subscriptions. But the next challenge was is to, for those who had Jet subscriptions and who may not be as familiar with the computer technology or may not how to convert them to that digital format and get them to enjoy it. Now, because I have an opportunity to have dinner with my mother every week, I just informed her that I would download the app, I would subscribe to the magazine, and then I would share it with her weekly. I would share this digital content. I would navigate it for her, show her how to navigate the content, and listen to the videos and scroll through, and just help her continue to get that reading the news from Jet, but also not taking advantage of the new content, the new video, and the other content that's being offered through that app. And so, I say that to say this. I'm encouraging all of us in our audience, and the Religion Means a Lot audience. Number one, we need to make a commitment to supporting African-American businesses, be it print or in the news business or radio, the broadcast business, or in any other avenues. We need to be committed to supporting that. And then when there's a shift in those businesses, so that those businesses can survive and be viable, those of us who can should embrace it. And then, if we can, help others come along. Is what I'm feeling I'm going to be doing with my mother. Helping her come along and still enjoying what the content that Jet put out, but simply now in the digital format. Right. Again, this is also a way to help maybe bridge what I refer to as that generational divide. Here's an opportunity to work with maybe a parent or another relative or loved one or just a close friend who may not be as comfortable using technology as you might be, but can still help them enjoy a publication, enjoy information, enjoy a publication that they have been used to, but now has been shifted away from a version and a format that they have become accustomed to. And this particular shift is going on in several publications. Jet just happens to be the most recent one. In fact, let me return to the article and just to point this out. Let me quote. Last month, the publisher of Ladies Home Journal said that after 130 years, the publication would cease as a monthly shifting to a digital and quarterly print format. Now, Ladies Home Journal, large circulated publication, primarily targeted to Caucasian women. But now, not going to be printed and published on a monthly basis, but it would be digital only and published on a quarterly basis, right? Again, so that they can survive. Right. This has always also happened to a Newsweek, US Today and News Report, and some other publications that have ceased their print publications and now are, as you can find, their information in a digital format. And as Ms. Rogers says, Jet Now, is hopefully going to be able to convert some of those who were just getting its print format, but hope to now to get some other and grow other adopters reading the content, because now it's in a digital format and will eventually be available on all mobile devices. And so, even though businesses are changing, and of course businesses must change in order to be successful. Here's an example of one that's an American business, long time in business, in the news business, making a change. But they were going to say, and I've probably been inclined to agree, that there's going to be a change for the better. Because now I don't have to wait for a publication to come in the mail or pick it up at a newsstand where it'll be printed. And sometimes by the time we get the news, much of the news is whole. You know, in today's, as they say, in today's media landscape, news that's older than 24 hours is old news, because the news can be cut down now within the next 30 seconds or even less. With the digital formats today, and with social media now is dominating so much of the media landscape, and so much news can be communicated through social media. Almost every broadcast outlet, be it large, whatever, has a digital footprint. They have either a website and where they carry much of their information, where they can go into much more detail than they can maybe in their on-air publications. On the on-air programming. And so I would say that Johnson Publishing, with their Jet magazine going digital, is really moving into positioning themselves in that important digital space and preparing themselves to be able to grow for the long run and continue just to provide this excellent format, excellent content now in a little different format. All right, so here again, returning to our second theme for the day, supporting African-American businesses. Now, I'd like to, in the last few minutes that I have with the Religion Means a Live Audience, I'd like to make some announcements and relate some important activities that are going on in the community that I think will be of interest to the Religion Means a Live Audience. This weekend, Of course, for those of you who may not be aware, Muslims all over the world, that is, those who subscribe to and follow the Islamic religion, are participating in a yearly program or activity referred to as Ramadan, the month of Ramadan. And this is a month where we fast during the daylight hours and then engage in more charitable work, more learning, and educating ourselves about our religion, and then fasting. That means abstaining from food or drink during the daylight hours. And we do this for 30 days. And so the there's a program that's been sponsored by the Mosque Cares. The Mosque Cares is a 501c3 religious charitable organization. It was started by Imam Badruddin Muhammad, and it was started for the express purpose of bringing to the whole world the correct understanding and the correct view of Islam, and to bring the correct view and to correct this misconceptive view that Islam has out there. Now, of course, Imam Muhammad passed away. He passed away over 5 years ago. But his son, Wahdatuddin Muhammad II, is continuing the work of his father with the charitable organization, the Mosque Cares. And so this weekend, that's July 18th, they are be conducting their annual Ramadan session. So this is a Ramadan session. And during the Ramadan session is where they bring together learned individuals in the religion of Islam. And these individuals that they bring together are individuals who were taught by by his father, Imam Wahdatuddin Muhammad. Taught by his father, learned and came to their understanding of the religion by his father. And so the Ramadan session will be take place here in Chicago. It will be at the Mosque Cares headquarters. The address is 929 West 171st Street in East Hazelcrest, Illinois. It will begin with Juma prayer, which is the Friday prayer service. And I want to mention or read some of the individuals who will be addressing the Ramadan session. Of course, they're referred to in our committee as imams, or religious leaders. Pull that up here. There will be individuals will be coming from all over the country to take part in the Ramadan session. So let me I'm here on the Mosque Cares website, and I want to go to their information here so I can read to you exactly who are some of the individuals who will be addressing the group that come together. And our list now, Abdul Kareem Muhammad, who's from New Jersey. Abdul Mohammedan, he's from Illinois. Abdullah Rasul Akbar from Georgia. Of course, Imam Alfred Muhammad from New Jersey, and he happens to be the host of this program that I happen to sit in as his guest host today. But Imam Alfred Muhammad will be addressing the audience there. Imam Eli Muhammad from Illinois. Imam Furqan Muhammad from Georgia. Imam Hafiq Muhammad II is from California. Imam Hameen Rasul is from Michigan. Imam Lozan Muhammad from Kansas City, from Kansas. Imam Nasir Ahmed, they don't have where he's from here. Imam Noah Saifullah from Michigan. Imam Omar Hamid from New Jersey. Imam Yusuf Ramadan from New York. And then, of course, the president of the mosque here is going to be addressing. And, of course, it's Wahiduddin Muhammad II, who is the president of the mosque here. So these are the individuals who will be addressing the audience that assembles there at the mosque here building. Again, as I said, it runs from July 18th through the 20th, 2014. And it's at 929 West 121st Street. He says, of course, Illinois. Attend the Ramadan session is $100. It takes care of your registration fee for all 3 days. They also have some vending opportunities. Of course, there's limited vending space, you can, a vendor who's interested in being a vendor is just an additional $50. So for vendors, the registration fee and the vending space, $150 covers all 3 days. And so I encourage all of the listening audience who may be interested to come and attend. If you've never attended, this is a tradition that was started by Imam Wahiduddin Muhammad and that he held during the Ramadan every year. And it was an opportunity for individuals to come together. And, of course, at the time when he was here alive, he led the study sessions. And in 10 study sessions, learned a great deal about the religion of Islam, how it should be practiced, how it should be propagated, and how it should be lived. And so this tradition continues with his son Imam, with his son Wahiduddin Muhammad, the second president of the mosque. As the tradition continues, and so I encourage those who are interested and have the opportunity, please come and attend the Ramadan sessions in East Hazelcrest, Illinois. And then I can't leave you without mentioning the 25th Annual Muslim Convention. This convention will take place this year, August 29th through the 30th, this year, 2014. It will take place at the Tentley Park Convention Center. Of course, that's in Tentley Park, Illinois, which is a suburb up here of Chicago. It's the 25th Annual Muslim Convention. So it promises to be a dynamic program, a historic and dynamic program. I would encourage all that if you want additional information about any of these programs, be it the Ramadan session or the Muslim, the 25th Annual Muslim Convention, you can go to the website, the Mosque Cares website. If you go to their website, they have information, of course, about these dynamic events and others. The web address is WDM Ministry. That's WDMMinistry.com. So if you type in WDMMinistry.com, it will take you to the web to the website. You can get information on both programs, the Ramadan session and the 25th Annual Muslim Convention. You can get information on these sessions, on these events, and of course on other programming and events that they have in addition to these two highlight events that I've highlighted today. So with that, I want to say thank you, number one, to Imam Alfred Muhammad for allowing me to be his guest host for A Religion in Mixed Life. As I say, this usually I come on the second Monday of the month, and I'm the guest co-host along with him. But he asked me to host it in his stead for this session, and it's been my pleasure to do so. I hope some of what I've said has been of interest to the Religion Means of Life community. I enjoy coming on the program and bringing information. I look forward to the next opportunity to come and share with you, with the Religion Means of Life community. I will let all of you know again now that even when I go off air, if you have an interest of sharing something with me that you didn't have an opportunity to call in and share, you can tweet me. Submit a tweet at, of course, twitter.com, and my handle is at Akbar1. That's at AKBARONE, at Akbar1. Now, and with that, dear people, I'd like to close and leave you, as I greeted, as I came on the program and greeted you, your honorable audience, honorable radio audience, I leave you with the greetings of peace of Assalamu Alaikum, and until such time as I have an opportunity to address you again, may the peace of the Creator be with you all.